Good afternoon. It is 1:30, January 14th, 2025. This is an informal hearing of the Public Service Commission with Montana Dakota Utilities and Applied Digital. The case numbers are PU24-330 and PU24-332. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Kringstad, do you? Commissioner Haugenhoffert, I'll turn it over to you for opening comments or to just carry us through.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone.
I want to emphasize it's an informal hearing, so that can only deal in undisputed information. If anything comes up that is in under dispute, we'll have to wrap this up and issue a notice of a formal hearing. And now,
I think before we get started, we should do introductions because I'm sure we have people listening online. So I will start with Adam to my right.
Adam Renfant, staff.
Etienne Snyman, Applied Digital.
Darcy Nigam, Montana Dakota Utilities.
Allison Walden with MDU Resources Group, representing Montana Dakota Utilities.
Travis Jacobson with Montana Dakota.
Stephanie Sievert with MDU Resources.
Brian Johnson, PSC staff.
Commissioner Jill Kringstad.
Do we need to introduce ourselves?
We got
Okay, sorry, first informal.
I think Randy, the commissioner, said all three commissioners are here. So, we have two cases before us, an informal. Data centers are a hot topic. And I think it's good that we meet and to go through some information. I think it will be good to do some recap, and I think we've reached out to you, Travis, to kind of go through that from the start to where we're at and these cases here. So generally it is the company. You have presented a PowerPoint presentation for us. I'll turn it over to you to go through things. I would hope with your consent that as you go through things, if there's questions, we're allowed to ask at that time. And I just want to be clear because we have them together. Are you first going to go through 24-330, or is it going to be kind of jointly, or how are you going to do that, just for the record, Travis, or Darcy, or whoever?
I think our plan was just to try to address the two dockets together at the same time, so if that's okay.
I have no objection with that. Do either one of you?
No. I don't.
Okay. So I'll turn it over to you for a presentation.
Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners, and thank you for the opportunity here to for this discussion in relation to the two previously mentioned cases. We are here today to discuss two applications filed by Montana Dakota in relation to its provision of electric service to its customer, Applied Digital. The first is an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity, authorizing the company to extend service requested by Applied. Second, Montana Dakota requests approval of Amendment Number 2 to the Applied Digital Electric Service Agreement. As a preliminary issue, the company has filed for trade secret protection in case PU24-332 related to certain information contained in Amendment Number 2 to the agreement. Specifically, Montana Dakota has requested confidential treatment of rate structure and cost information. This information was similarly designated as confidential in the two previous proceedings related to the Applied Digital Agreement. The company is prepared to address any questions that you may have in relation to that information, but we do request that it take place during a confidential session as permitted by the administrative rules. Without further ado, then, I will turn it over to Darcy to give you the presentation.
Travis, you were going to start with the first line? Okay.
We should.
Okay.
Okay, I'll start with the first slide. In the docket that Allison introduced, the PCNN, that was filed September 11th. To Commissioner Haugen-Hoffert's request there, you know, this adds additional area adjacent to existing CPCNs that we have. So there's quite a few dockets here, and so maybe just going through those, we have some certificates that were requested to serve the first electric service area, or electric service agreement, I should say, with Applied Digital, which was 180 megawatts.
Travis, I think what would be beneficial is if you brought up this map and point to it and say, this was the first Applied CPCN and what you could share there without, and I think this is a good map.
Okay.
Do you have a clicker where you can point?
So if Darcy maybe wants to highlight. So I had mentioned the first electric service agreement, which was 180 megawatts. And Darcy will point to that. So we did a tour down there. I know some of the commissioners have attended, some of the staff, and that is the, and Etienne can correct me if I'm wrong, but or add in, but there's a series of buildings there, and that is really related to the mining of the Bitcoin and those type of processes. If you were down for the most recent tour, the second electric service agreement, and Darcy has that highlighted now, is in the blue there. That's 225 megawatts, and that building is still being built, and they're looking for a tenant on that. And there was a certificate that was also requested for that particular addition.
When is that looking at being completed? Do you know
the construction?
Yep.
We're expecting to have that facility fully in operation by the end of this year, with the first production or first commissioning in, I believe it's Q3 of this year. Commissioning activities are ongoing right now since energization as of a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, thank you.
And so then that leads us to the amendment to the second electric service agreement that will be in the purple area that you can see up there that Darcy's highlighting. What essentially that's doing is it's expanding the area to cover the east half of that section. And Darcy, if you want to go to the next slide.
Do you mind if I just add a little bit more there? Just going back to the prior slide. So that the second ESA was for 225 megawatts. The building that we're constructing on there right now would consume a total of 130 megawatts. So the remainder of that 225 plus what we have asked for here will be used in the purple section that you see up there.
So that purple section is going to be the expansion of from 225 to
350. Yes. Actually, it's what we're envisioning is that the full, so with this amendment, it'll add up to a total of 530 megawatts between ESA 1, ESA 2, plus this amendment. And that 530 megawatts we anticipate will be used in the blue square there, the building that's currently under construction, as well as the purple square at the top. So we anticipate to have the 180 megawatts redirected towards artificial intelligence as well.
And that's in the purple area?
That's in the purple area, yes.
And that's not under construction yet?
No, it's, well, we started to move some dirt for that, but it's not advancing to construction.
Just for curiosity, starting to move dirt, anticipated completion when?
So it's two buildings that we're anticipating there, each adding up to about 200 megawatts each. And I think we're expecting So if we look at the current HPC building, so disregard the Bitcoin mining, we're calling the building that's currently under construction as phase one. Phase two, which is another 200 megawatts, we're expecting in 2026, earlier part of 2026, and phase three in earlier part of 2027. And those three phases will add up to the 530 megawatts.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. You kind of lost me a little bit. The 225, but then I think you said that now you're not going to use that much there. And so some of that will be shifted up into these two new buildings, right?
That's right.
The purple.
Correct.
The purple.
Into the purple, yes.
Yeah. And so the 225, how much do you anticipate that one is actually going to use now?
Well, we're anticipating to use all of it as we build out the facility. But the first building that's under construction, which I believe you've seen, that's 130 megawatt building.
Okay.
And that's the Bitcoin. That's upper. No.
No, the Bitcoin is, and I apologize for the confusion. So the Bitcoin is existing 180 megawatts.
Right.
The new high performance, the new AI building that's under construction.
The blue.
Is in the blue, and that's 130 megawatts. So, and that is being served by the 225. So that leaves about 95 megawatts, plus what we're requesting here today, plus the 180 megawatts from the Bitcoin, will serve the purple square eventually.
Does that mean you're imagining the Bitcoin going away?
Redirected to artificial intelligence at some point.
Oh, okay. I was coming up with like 700 and something.
Well, I will take the 700 too. Yeah. But yes, so eventually it'll add up into three phases. The 130 megawatts, which is the large building that's in construction right now, plus two phases of 200 megawatts each.
And that's why you don't call them phase one, phase two, and phase three, because phase one probably evaporates.
Yeah, I apologize that I'm... We've moved on kind of from the Bitcoin phase where we don't even call it a phase anymore. So phase one is the 130 megawatt building under construction, and then phase two and three... are two new buildings of 200 megawatts each. And that's where we anticipate to be in the future, where the power of the Bitcoin mine going to the Bitcoin mining right now will be redirected.
And phase two, three, the two new buildings is the purple.
Correct.
Yes. When do you look at transitioning the Bitcoin to AI?
So that'll be with phase three. That'll be sort of the last. We're looking to keep the Bitcoin operational for, you know, until we need to redirect that power, or until that other building is available to use that power. And anticipate we'll have to come talk to you about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Look forward to it.
Okay. You'll get to see a lot of me.
Well, thank you so much for going through that overview and the changes that are occurring. Okay.
So now that we're all straight on that, well, one thing I hadn't mentioned, but everybody's aware of, we had reached a service area agreement, and that was filed with the commission. That was approved in March 24. And so what that did was, it created a service territory around the initial 180 megawatts of Applied's load, approximately a mile around that. So if we go to the next slide, you'll see there this map came right out of our service area agreement, and it highlights four sections of land that Montana-Dakota then has a service territory there. And if you look in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see Section 4, 12963. The east half of that then would all be covered under a certificate to serve Apply Digital for the existing 180 as well as Phase 1, 2, and 3 of their future operations. And so then just
for clarification, so your current service area agreement serves only what?
So if you go back one slide, Darcy, the current ones are the blue and yellow.
Okay, and you're expanding to the purple?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Just clarifying.
Yep. Yep, that's correct. And then, again, relative to the certificate, Dakota Valley Cooperative did submit an email indicating that they will not protest, mm-hmm. and that is in the docket as well. And then if I could just add one more thing, I didn't introduce Stephanie Sievert. She introduced herself, but there's been some changes up at Resources with the spin related to Everest and prior to that, Knife River. So we've kind of restructured everything around the utility and the pipeline company. And so Stephanie is now she is the chief accounting officer as well as over the regulatory function here at the utility. And so I just wanted to highlight that.
Thank you. As of Monday, so new to the job.
Welcome.
You're a veteran.
I am. That's right.
And with that, I think that concludes the certificate side of it, unless there are other questions before we get there.
Can I go back to this map for a moment? And this is the one on the fourth page of your handout. You were talking about sections, and I see Section 4 that is not square and Section 3 that is not square. So is that two half sections, and so you together they make the equivalent of a section?
No,
or
they're...
What am I misunderstanding?
Well, I think you're missing there's Section 9 and 10 in there as well.
Oh, I didn't... Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So... You own all of that in the blue. That's all for current and maybe future expansion?
So that is the service area agreement
yep.
between Dakota Valley and Montana Dakota. So anything within that, we have an agreement with Dakota Valley that we
right.
have the...
That territory.
That territory.
The right correct. To serve.
Yep, that's correct. And then, you know, in the map then, part of why I included this, it shows the relationship to the town of Ellendale, which is just off on the right side of that. So we're just out of town there. There's nothing else, Darcy?
Okay. Thank you, commissioners. So talking about the ESA number 2, when we've talked about the parts in this amendment. So this amendment number 2 was filed on September 5th. 2024. We talked already that it does increase the amount of megawatts that are underneath the electric service agreement by an additional 125, so that's how we get to the 350 megawatt level. We did include in that there is an extension of the 5-year term of the agreement. So Applied has not started taking any load yet under ESA number 2, as we would call this. And so, you know, it was perceived that the agreement had a 5-year term to it, at which point it could be renewed if we came back into the commission and sought reapproval of an additional 5-year term or whatever it would be. So what we're looking at doing is basically resetting the term on that, you know, to the earlier of the approval of this ESA amendment number 2, or it would be a start date of September 1st, 2025. So that could push the expiration of the second amendment out to August 31st, 2030, depending upon when this amendment would be approved. So if it would be approved today, then it would run through January 14th of 2030, it would run through is the way that that amendment is structured. Okay. The other one that we had for an amendment in the ESA amendment number two is we did modify some of the payment terms around the demand charges that was a part of Exhibit B to that. And so one of the things we wanted to do, if there was any capacity payments that would end up being made, if we'd go out to the auction or would secure that capacity from a third party, we would basically include in the next billing cycle all of that, you know, payment amount to apply to be paid. And to, even though, you know, it may stretch out over a year, the capacity would do, we basically said it would all be paid at least in the next monthly invoice. And that was to avoid changing any of the capacity or the credit requirements that we ended up having with applying. And then also included in that amendment number two would end up being an updated map that Travis had walked through to show which additional properties we were including inside the ESA.
Darcy, before we go to the next slide, I just want to clarify, do you anticipate any other upgrades to any of your current, like, physical infrastructure at all?
There are no upgrades required other than what is just locally at Ellendale to serve the applied load.
Okay.
Okay. Nothing beyond that. Okay. So any other questions on what's included in the amendment number two? And then I can walk through beyond that just some additional information around the project itself.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the benefits, you know, that Applied has to our North Dakota customers and at least the increase in the megawatts that we have from the 225 to 350. And ultimately, as Etienne talks about, you know, this ultimate 530 megawatt level, you know, customers do receive the benefits from this customer through the transmission rider for the transmission service they take. And that is all reimbursed 100% back to customers that we flow back. Also, through the fuel and purchase power adjustment, there is, you know, a portion of that transaction charge that we have as part of the rate that also does flow back to customers. The other one is, in the last rate case, there also is a potential for some additional incremental earning savings and refunds that also potentially could come into play with a customer like this. So the annual effect as far as on residential customers, and this would be at that full 530 megawatt amount, could end up being an approximate savings of $200 on an annual basis that they could basically receive back on a credit between the transmission service and also on the sharing mechanism for the transaction charge.
And that's contemplate that category, that average residential customer that we always use in
yep,
cases
that's right.
And such, right?
So when we had the initial electric service agreement, and I think in the settlement as a part of that, you know, we agreed to go off and do a market study, mm-hmm. taking a look at what was the impact on fuel and purchase power and LNP prices within MISO within this area. You know, so we had did that study, and we had also contemplated, I think as in a second phase that was a part of that study, some additional load that potentially could have been somewhere in that area, you know, whether it was at Ellendale or another location. So we kind of had information that talked about what additional expansion would look like. We went back with the same consultant that did that study, and we updated it, you know, prior to entering into this amendment number two with Applied to see what we would be the impacts of servicing this load, at least on that study. So we went back and we did look at the full 530 megawatts of load addition and what that would do to fuel and purchase power as far as impacts at least to the rest of our customer base. And so in looking at that, you know, we end up with, I'm going to jump ahead one slide. You know, we did have several cases that we've looked at. And so in those cases, we ended up with a base case that would have been part of the original 1898 study. And in that, we looked at, without any data center load, potentially what could be our total fuel and purchase power to serve customers. And then in case one, we ended up adding in, not expecting Applied to be at a full 180 megawatts, maybe at 170, what their average would be. What did case one end up having as far as for that amount? And case two, we looked at an additional 170 megawatts. So that's what made up cases one and two. Cases three and four, we actually expanded that and actually looked at in case three would be the full 530 megawatts that we would end up having at Ellendale. And then case four actually contemplated an additional 50 megawatts of load potentially. I think we've had an agreement we signed in South Dakota for a load down at Loyola, South Dakota. And so we contemplated all of those load additions, at least in the 1898 study. And so in that, there are potential LNP costs over that study period that came back that we included in our in-house modeling that we use for calculating our annual fuel and purchase power. That ends up being the Plexos modeling that we do. And so dispatched our generation resources around the changed LNPs because that's what the 1898 study gives us. And this ends up being the impact and the change cases we would have from the base case fuel and purchase power that as we step through these additional load cases, showing what that increases to customers. So we end up seeing, we end up with about a little less than a 2% increase in customers' fuel and purchase power associated with this load at Ellendale. And so that equates back to potentially the cost to customers then on an average residential ends up being in this $3 to $4 range, at least for that 2% increase in fuel and purchase power.
Go back to the other one, please. I'm not trying to go, as you add more, it would seem like your fuel and purchase power should grow incrementally. Mm-hmm. How come the third addition actually reduces it?
So in the base case, good question, Mr. Christman. In the base case, cases one and two, that was our original assumptions. You know, one of the things we saw as we got into the 1898 study, there was another constraint that started to pop up in the modeling. And that dealt with the North Dakota export limit, where that's a historic number, at least for energy that can be, you know, transmitted across the seam between North Dakota and Minnesota. And so in that, that limit for an export-import was being kind of up and against what that amount would be where there started to be congestion based upon North Dakota export limit. That number is stale as far as it has not been updated between MISO and SPP because they both have to agree to that. And so as there's been more transmission projects across that seam, you know, which would include like the Big Stone South to Ellendale line and between Big Stone South down to Brookings back to the Twin Cities and the other work that's occurred along that path, we know that that limit is too low. And so one of the assumptions that was made in change cases three and four was to remove that limit or set it artificially higher so it wasn't impacting the outputs from the model. And so that's why there was a little bit of change from case three to two is that North Dakota index limit was being impacted slightly in case two. And so when we got to case three, then that impact was removed from the modeling in three and four.
But if you used the same assumptions, then change case two would have been lower.
So we didn't rerun cases one and two. We basically left them as they were, and we just had the consultant look at three and four because that's what we were interested in was the additional megawatts. So we did not remove the index limit from cases one or two. If we would have, it would have made that change case two go down, and we wouldn't see that change from 1.7 to 1.6 back up to 1.8.
So. Okay, and the size of these things are so big from what we've traditionally contemplated. I just want to clarify. On page six, the $200 savings for the average residential at full capacity, that's per year, right?
Per year.
And then on page seven, the increased fuel and purchase power costs is over what period of time?
That would be over an annual.
That's an annual as well.
Okay, so we're then, talking 30 cents a month or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And then perspective, if you remember when we did our transmission tracker, you know, just mid-year last year, you know, that equated to right around $75 a year. And again, that's just with the 180 megawatt Bitcoin in there as it stands today. So, you know, relatively speaking, that, you know, it, I guess it bears out the 200 relative to the 75 that we have in there today.
So any other questions on this analysis? If not,
Adam,
then
do
I
you have something?
Yeah. Do you think we could talk at all about where you intend to procure that capacity and maybe your capacity strategy in general going forward, or would that be better addressed in a closed session?
I think it would be. We can talk about that. So it's good that you brought that up. I was going to cover that next, Adam. One of the things when we originally got into ESA number one, so the original 180 megawatts, you know, one of the things with rate 45 is it does allow for a customer to be an interruptible load. And then if you're an interruptible load, you can satisfy your capacity obligation by being willing to reduce your load either when one of the hours the company called upon it or on one of the MISO capacity and energy emergency hours. So you don't need to get capacity from somewhere else. You could self-supply it. And that's the way rate 45 was set up. And what we did in ESA 1 and 2 was there was some amount of interruptibility, and the customer could select that level of interruptibility they wanted to have each year. Okay. And that's the way that ESA number 1 works. We end up with a significant portion, the original 180 megawatts, that ends up being interruptible, and they're registered as a load-modifying resource, so they self-supply their capacity needs. As we talk about ESA number 2 and phases 1, 2, and 3, one of the things Applied has, and Etienne can talk about this as well, is at least from the difference in the type of data application or the company, there's a desire to have more of a firm-like supply and not be susceptible to the same interruption capabilities, at least that ESA number 1 would have. So looking at the rate 45 and looking at the language in the ESA, we do believe that it allows that because the customer can select every year in a different amount of firm that they want to have. And basically, we would be in a place to work with the customer if they have firm energy. As it says in the ESA, we would go out and either procure that from others, or if we had excess, sell it to them. Or if that doesn't get occur, we could actually go out to the capacity market to be able to service that. So when we take a look at ESA number two now,
on ESA one though,
mm-hmm.
You say the customer can choose how much interruptibility.
Correct.
But the less they choose, the more capacity you have to acquire elsewhere. Right? I mean, there's consequences to going too low.
Sure. From ESA number one, I mean, let's just take numbers for example. It's 180 megawatt load. Okay. If they end up saying they want 10 megawatts that's firm, there's 170 then that they're saying they can interrupt that amount. And so you can actually register that 170 megawatts of curtailment capability for that customer as basically a supply-side resource. So you can use that to meet your capacity obligation because you're committing that under a capacity and energy emergency, when MISO looks to interrupt any demand response customer load-modifying resource, that they would basically reduce their load. It would look just like if you had a standby generation on site and you agreed to run backup generation. Instead of doing that, in the case of ESA number one, they're just agreeing to reduce their load. And they can self-supply the capacity needs they have.
And does that agreement limit the number of hours in that example that the 170 can be curtailed?
So in that agreement, there was an hour listed. And then it also talks about an all for all MISO capacity and energy emergencies.
Okay.
Okay. Any questions on that? And then I'll talk about ESA number two. And that's a little bit of the change because of the type of load that Applied is looking at serving. And for that type of load where there's more of an amount of firm that customer wants, there ends up being, as Adam is saying, something we need to be able to show capacity annually to be able to meet that load obligation. So one of the things that Applied is doing is they are working on, I think there's a separate docket filed with this commission, at least on some additional generation on site, mm-hmm. that they're looking at having for a purpose. The other one is there also is a possibility that capacity could be purchased from some third parties. that Applied is looking at, or it's something that, you know, we may have an interest as well, or others, of being able to, you know, supply other sorts of resources or deploy other resources in the future for. There's some additional conversations we're still having around how we meet that capacity obligation. The last piece is we could always go off to the market and procure it in whatever the market clears at, and then basically pass that cost along to Applied.
Would that reduce the benefits, the overall benefits to the customers, that $200?
That wouldn't change that because the transmission service is based upon their peak load, so it doesn't change their peak. And the other portion of that benefit deals with the total number of megawatt hours we sell, so that doesn't change either. The only thing it is, if we get into a situation where we would call on an hour, you know, there would be less interruptible load associated with that project than what we would have for phase one.
But haven't we approved that ESA 2?
ESA 2 is approved for 225 megawatts.
Yep, and that backup generation.
The backup generation docket, I believe, is still open.
Okay.
Or maybe not. I'm not involved with that, so I can't answer that.
I thought it was
temporary construction. Yeah. I think.
Yeah, that's correct. It's temporary variance has been granted for the generation.
Yep.
So that generation has been picked, right? Correct. Has that generation been selected? The type.
Yes, and it's in construction.
Okay, yeah, those diesel generators, right?
180 megawatts of diesel generation is under construction.
How many hours does that get you? And is that just primarily used for backup, given how expensive it would be to run?
That's right. It's primarily the primary purpose of it is for backup generation. I think the limitation is on the emission side of things, which I think allows for 200 hours at this standpoint. Some of that will be used for just operations, turning the engines over every once in a while, making sure it's available. Though we did lay out the facility such as to allow for additional emissions control in the future, such that we can revisit that number to install ACRs, essentially.
Okay, so then could you actually become completely interruptible, knowing how costly that would be, and then knowing how few times LMRs get called?
Our tenants have asked us to, have requested that we procure capacity for firm delivery. But technically, like physically speaking, and in terms of MISO rules, I believe that is capable. We did look at the actual LMR curtailments over the last, I think, 15 years, and there would have been two curtailments for a total of, I think it's a few hours, 6 hours or something like that.
I think it's 6 hours in like 10 years.
Over 15 years, though, our tenants have requested that we secure firm capacity to service that load in addition to the on-site generation. But I do see that as an opportunity for us to kind of keep revisiting to see if there's opportunities to use that generation. As a generation person, it pains me to know of that generation sitting there not being used otherwise. So we will, you know, continue to evaluate how we can best use that capacity that sits there. And there is also a diesel pipeline that runs close to the site, half a mile from the site. So there are some opportunities for ongoing diesel supply. And you're right, it's more expensive, but the price that the market will probably be at when you want to turn on that generation will still be higher than what it would cost to generate.
So any other questions on that change as far as the amount of firm and interruptible power potentially supplied?
So it sounds like the primary intention for that capacity need would be to find an agreement with another supplier who has excess. And the market, the MISO capacity auction is the backup. What if there's nothing left to buy in the MISO market.
So the market would always clear, and there always would be a cost associated with it? And so the market never gets in a place that... So if the obligations are not all satisfied, if there ends up being some amount of deficit, then the market, in a sense, clears at the cost of new entry, or CONE, and basically that's how the market process ends. Should there isn't anything that goes back to an entity that then says somehow you're harmed other than just being that financial cost to purchase that capacity at CONE.
Sure. So that would be, that's the backstop is the worst of the worst. If
that is the
capacity
backstop.
Auction doesn't has no more resources left, CONE is what the payment is.
Correct.
I didn't hear the end of what you said, Victor.
Sure. So if in the event of a MISO capacity auction running out of excess capacity mm-hmm. to sale, the backstop is the cost of new entry or CONE price. It's a kind of a common reference in the MISO world. It's the absolute backstop. If there's no more excess generation, how much does it cost on an annual basis to build new generation? And that's the fee that market mechanism sets. So if there is no more capacity, you still pay that top dollar cost of new entry price, and the market is satisfied.
The auction is satisfied.
Yes, sir. So the auction is satisfied. That is a much better way to put this. So.
If you don't mind, I'll add a little bit more color there. There is a clear preference from our tenants to secure capacity over an extended period of time, 10-plus years. So we do have conversations with generators in the state that have capacity available that they can provide under long term, and also with some entities who are interested in building and investing in new capacity resources to provide that. And when you procure, when you show up with a 10, 15, 20-year agreement, it provides room for backstopping some of that new investment. So I'll expect you'll probably see some of that over the coming months.
Is there any particular kind of resource that you're looking at? I mean, only certain types of generation, or are they open to...
Open to anything, really.
That's great.
Yeah.
So we wanted to highlight this conversation, and at least kind of this change, I think, is how we originally described, you know, at least the service at Ellendale, that there was more of this desire for firm capacity and also that ability that the customer has as well of looking to source their own generation and potentially find a way to service that capacity from others. So as we looked at rate 45 and what's in the ESA, you know, we do see the customer is able to make this change election annually. So we just wanted to make sure that we were clear as far as how we had portrayed this project opportunity going forward, that the commission understood kind of this change that was happening as they move from the crypto mining over to the high-performance computing. And that ends up being the end of the presentation that I have.
Well, I got a question. It has to do with NERC's latest assessment on reliability. And their 2024 long-term reliability assessment, and MISO is in a high-risk area. Have you seen this?
I have seen that.
Okay. How do you want to address that with being in the MISO region, the trend being data centers and the request here? Demand growth is rapidly, driven by electrification, data centers, industrial loads. This is being out there.
It is.
On the state, regionally, nationally. So... Yeah.
We're supportive of NERC's assessment and how they've come out to be, in kind of a word, sort of a source of truth as we talk about the industry as a whole. You know, one of the things I think that's helpful in what NERC came out with in the reliability assessment, I think this is the second year, maybe third year in a row, where there's kind of been that elevated status as far as in the MISO region. some of that is reflective of when they look at the results of the last capacity auction. You know, in the case of MISO, there was one region that cleared at Cone, that there was Indiana, Illinois. One of those ended up clearing at Cone because there was actually a shortage in one of the seasons that they ended up having. So it's one of the things that NERC picked up on, I think, of saying in their assessment that generally they think MISO is good, but there are certain conditions potentially under which there may be more of a reliability issue to serve load. So it wasn't a general of the whole footprint, but I think more of that reflection on a particular area and as far as how the market cleared. The other one, NERC's assessment, and they've been making this comments for a couple years, and MISO has as well, you know, I think is really helping utilities to end up seeing the pace that sometimes they're considering retirements of baseload units. And there have been a lot of utilities that have changed their plans recently because of some of the directions and information that NERC has put out. And also MISO trying to ask utilities to delay some of those retirements until they can ensure at least that, you know, there is an adequate margin to reliability and we're not getting into an energy, you know, transition, you know, too quickly across the footprint as a whole. When we talk about the Ellendale load and we talk about its impact that it has on the broader MISO market, you know, in the case of their entire load at 530 megawatts compares with the entire footprint load that's over 120,000 megawatts. You know, so we aren't increasing the total MISO load by 5-10%. You know, we're talking about something that's in that 0.5% sort of range that we end up talking about on peak. So just from that point of context.
Although how many others are adding 0.5% or 1%?
Sure. And I think that's some of the reasons when we've talked with Applied and others. I mean, we're either into the place of looking at generation, which they're doing for having standby generation on site. The other one that the commission, well, I guess we would talk about, is the place where if we start running out of generation, we get into is we get into having, you know, things like load shed events that happen. That's kind of the backstop on reliability is load shed. And if MISO ever got in that situation, the first loads that we're going to come after and asking for customers to curtail are going to be the data centers. And we'll be able to satisfy our full amounts because of the largeness, at least, that loads have. If they're 530 megawatts and the rest of our load is 600, you know, we're going to be asked to reduce maybe 10, 15, 20% of our load. We would always go after those data center loads, and the rest of our customers wouldn't see that impact from having to be called to have their service interrupted. And we would go after the data center, one, because we know they end up having the standby generation, that they can basically be able to handle that call, at least that we don't have to go to other customers.
I believe your intent. Is there anything written in somewhere that is the order of load shed?
So that ends up being ours.
So that data centers come first? I'm not familiar with that in SPP.
No, but that gets to the load serving entity itself has that way they implement that. So generally, the RTO will call and say, you need to reduce 50 megawatts of load. And then it's up to the load-serving entity to say how they would do it. From our standpoint, we are saying we would go after the data center customers first, you know, and basically look for them to make those load reductions.
What if they say no?
Well, we have that ability, one, to basically, you know, open their service on them if they need it. We also have, you know, the agreements with the data center as well and understanding that when it comes to those sorts of requests, we would come after them. And that's one of the pieces that they've been told us that they're willing to do. Otherwise, we can open breakers and just terminate service to meet our obligations for reliability.
And the ESA does contemplate MISO curtailments. That is still in there. Unlimited amount of MISO curtailments is captured in the ESA. So it is provided contractually for. And in this case, if MISO instructs them to MDU to curtail, that would be considered a MISO curtailment.
Well, I've got a question here. So then But if you got, if you bought ZRCs and if you were leaning into ZRCs, let's say for the 100% of the megawatts in it, who then would you still be subject to? Because you would then have firmed up all your generation. Would you still have the ability as the local provider to then step in and, let's say, open a breaker? Or how does that work if it is, if they're are relying on, let's say, ZRCs for to firm up their generation as opposed to maybe having you maybe someone else build generation, or like if you built generation, let's say.
Okay. So when it gets to zonal resource credit, ZRCs, or how you meet your capacity obligation, that's all on a planning basis. So that's before the actual day you've basically shown what's the requirement and how do I meet that. Okay. When you get into the actual day, all of the load, you know, ends up being, I don't want to say served on the same basis, but there are various levels at which you would go after certain loads if it gets into capacity and energy emergency. You know, the first step you kind of get into is looking at load modifying resources after they call on all generation to take those interruptibles. They'll reduce their loads or they'll put on standby generation. And then at some point you turn into, irregardless of your ZRCs, it'll come back to the utilities that ends up saying you have so many megawatts to reduce over this period of time. And then a lot of utilities will just go and rotate that through various loads that they end up having for whatever that duration is.
Okay, so then if they someone else, if they bought someone else's ZRCs, would you still be in the position to manage a load shed?
Yes.
Okay.
Because, like I said, the ZRCs only matter on the planning basis. It doesn't work into the actual day,
operations.
The
okay.
actual operating day.
Okay. 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 Yeah. Thanks.
Anything else, Adam?
Nothing. Right.
Victor. So does anyone have questions of a confidential nature that do you want to go into an executive session?
No, I think it got addressed.
Okay, then is there anything else that you wanted to add? That went fast and
yeah, nothing further from the company, Commissioner. And if there should be any additional questions from the commission, please reach out. We'd be happy to answer them. Thank you for your time today.
Okay. So to re-clarify for staff as well, are there any objections to the evidence produced here today becoming part of the official record? And by the evidence, I mean both the handouts that were presented as well as the record, the oral testimony that was has been recorded?
None from staff.
No objection from the company.
Okay. So the evidence will become part of the record upon which a decision will be made. Are there any other matters for the record?
Nothing from the company.
Okay. This informal hearing is closed. Thank you all.